It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
All right. We are continuing. I believe this is the final installment of the upcoming election endorsements. Would that be correct, sir?
Well, the upcoming election. The endorsements are upcoming, too, but they'll be done in a few minutes. So anybody who's not interested, you can tune back in about 10 minutes. The top two... primary is on the 19th of August. Some people have already sent their ballots in. Other people will do it between now and Tuesday. Other people will vote on Tuesday. And as we mentioned before, there aren't a whole lot of races that are meaningful this time because the top two finishers in each race will go on to the November ballot. And in a lot of races, there's only one or two competitive candidates. But there are a few where there are more than two running, and those are in the... in the state legislative and particularly the judicial races, which are the ones that people know less about. So we wanted to spend a little bit of time today going through some of those. I'm going to skip the legislative races and the judicial races that are unopposed, and which is actually a majority of the legislative races in Seattle. But I do want to talk about a handful where there are candidates running, where there is a significant choice. And let's start with the 11th District, which is in South Seattle and Renton, where State Senator Marguerite Prentice has been a champion for the Sonics, as she has been in the past for any number of other sports stadia and arena. She has taken an enormous amount of money and carried a lot of water in Olympia for the payday loan industry, which is one of the more really despicable examples of entrepreneurship in our state.
Predatory,
thank you. I think the word racist also applies in many cases, certainly classist. And she is a Democrat, and she's facing a couple of other Democrats in this primary. Juan Martinez is running a grassroots campaign against her, and he deserves all the support possible. So we're recommending Juan Martinez in the 11th. And really, it would be a wonderful idea if there were some other Democrats in the legislative caucus from Seattle that got this sort of a challenge also, because Prentice is not the only one who is either Prentice is particularly bad, but there are a number who simply do nothing with their lifetime sinecures, so they don't deserve to have lifetime sinecures. We have a couple of open seats, one in the 36th, which is the area around Magnolia and Queen Anne and Ballard. And in that, we have two contrasting styles between two fairly progressive Democrats. We have John Burbank, who's sort of the old Union Paul, who's been around Democratic circles forever. And we have Reuven Carlisle, who is more of a young corporate entrepreneur type. I'm going with Carlisle in that one. I don't think in terms of the issues they're that different. But we just don't need more Democratic insider politicians in Olympia. We've seen what happens with a lot of folks when they do go to Olympia, and it's not very productive. Carlisle, I think, has much more of an upside to him. The 37th District, Eric Pettigrew is facing a challenge from Libertarian Ruth Bennett. And we've been critical of Pettigrew in the past, which is why I mentioned this one, because he has taken on a role in the last year or so in Olympia of being a real advocate for affordable housing measures, and we need more of that in Olympia. So even though Bennett is actually a fairly good candidate and has been endorsed by Eat the State in the past, we're going to go with Eric Pettigrew in that one. And then the 46th is the other open seat. That's North Seattle, where Helen Summers is retiring. And this also is a contrast of styles between Scott White, who tends to be the more connected Democratic type, and Jerry Paulette, the executive director of Heart of America Northwest, longtime environmental advocate around Hanford issues. And he has been described by many of his detractors as a pit bull. And in this case, that's actually kind of a compliment, because he's...
But a pit bull in a good way.
He very much fights for what he believes in, and that is sorely missing in our Seattle Legislative Caucus. So we're going with Jerry Paulette in that one. And then we wanted to spend some time on the state Supreme Court and judicial races. There's a couple people running for re-election that deserve re-election. Mary Fairhurst and Charles Johnson are good. The state Supreme Court position 7, however, incumbent Deborah Stephens is unopposed. So we suggest you skip that one, simply because nobody is running unopposed. I mean, this isn't supposed to be the Soviet Union, so they don't need your vote. The Court of Appeals Division 1, District 1, similarly, Linda Lau and Ann Schindler are unopposed. King County Superior Court has a number of positions up for ballot, and some of them are three-way races, so the choice this time is actually fairly important. Position number 1, Susan Amini, was the person who got our endorsement. She's running against Suzanne Parisian, who spent 2 decades as a corporate lawyer for Nordstrom. So we much prefer Susan Amini, who has gotten a lot of support from progressives and is a fixture in the East Side nonprofit circles. Regina Cahen in position number 10 is the more qualified of the endorsements. Position number 22, this is one of the two races that are a really good example of why there's so much hazard in electing judges in down-ticket races where people don't know very much. In this particular case, a woman named Holly Hill has poured a ton of her own money, about $70,000, in a race where the three candidates have each raised between $10,000 and $15,000 from other people. And $75,000 in a digital race buys you a lot of names, lawn signs, a lot of mailers, a lot of name recognition in a race that depends heavily on name recognition, simply because most people don't know anything about how lawyers or judges operate in the courtroom. So what Hill is doing essentially is trying to buy herself a judgeship, which we think is a really bad precedent. Fortunately, there are the other two candidates in the race are pretty good. Rebecca Graham is the one who got our endorsement in that one, in position number 22. And the other example of a real problem is position number 26, where by all accounts, Laura Jean Middaugh is a very good judge. She is running for re-election, but the problem is that advocates of all-terrain vehicles and various other, you know, big noisy machines in the environment have a grudge against Adam Kahn, because basically he told their one of the group's lobbyists to go jump in the lake. Well, what does that have to do with this judicial race? Well, Adam Kahn is married to Laura Jean Middaugh, and so to get back at Kahn, they are putting a bunch of money into the campaign of a 28-year-old lawyer with virtually no legal experience, fresh out of law school, who's spectacularly unqualified for a superior court position. But they're doing it basically to mess with Kahn by trying to have revenge on his wife. That's a really bad way to elect a judge. So
it's despicable.
It really is. So Laura Jean Middaugh in position number 26, and vote for her several times if necessary. And then Superior Court position 37, we have Nick Corning is the better of the two candidates in that one. Position number 53, Marianne Spearman was the candidate that we went with. And finally, there's one initiative in their race for on the ballot rather this month. That is Initiative 26, and it's a little bit complicated because it's a two-part question. One is that the initiative itself needs to be approved this time for it to go on to the November ballot. In other words, we're voting in August on whether it should appear on the ballot in November. So it's a yes-no as to whether it should appear, and it's a really bad idea. Basically, the initiative would make the King County Executive, the County Assessor, I believe it is, and all of the County Council members nonpartisan positions. And that sounds all and well, but what it actually is an effort by local Republicans to hide the idea that the Republicans running for this race are, in fact, Republicans, because their brand isn't very... It's the same reason that Dean Rossi is calling himself GOP Party, which is, you know, an assault on grammar, if nothing else. It really is an effort to hide affiliations and ideology rather than to make the positions nonpartisan, because they're not going to be nonpartisan. They're simply too powerful for that. So we're recommending no on that. But in the event it does pass, the question then becomes, should the initiative as originally worded go on the November ballot, or should it be the council-approved alternative, which would allow candidates to state a party preference if they so chose. And we're recommending also that if it does appear on the November ballot, that it be the council-approved alternative. And that's the primary for November. All of that's available at eatthestate.org. It's up on the web as we speak.
Very good. Moving on to a local and a couple signature drives.
Yeah, speaking of election-type things, these are things that would go on the ballot for next year, though, not for this year. One of them is the state Supreme Court ruled this week that the recall petition against Seattle Port Commissioner Pat Davis could go ahead. And activist Chris Clifford has been trying to collect signatures to recall Davis for malfeasance. His effort was challenged in court. He now, because he's won the court battle, can go out and start his 6 months. His little 6 month clock ticker just started for him to be able to collect signatures on the recall for Pat Davis. This is all surrounding the retirement of Mick Dinsmore as port chief when all of a sudden a little memo appeared in his personnel file signed only by Commissioner Davis saying that he qualified for a golden parachute of somewhere around $300,000 for his salary to continue being paid to him for up to a year after he had left office. It turns out that that's the sort of thing that has to be approved by committee in an open public meeting and should have at least been signed by other commissioners. Davis didn't do that. She approved it all on her own and signed the memo and slipped it into his file and said nothing to the other commissioners. And the state Supreme Court basically ruled that, her malfeasance was, quote, supported by the record and demonstrated by the fact that the Port Commission had to hold a public meeting in order to undo Commissioner Davis's contract with Dinsmore, end quote. So now the 6 months are ticking, and Clifford will have to collect about 150,000 signatures in order to get the recall measure put on the ballot in King County. And if you want to read more about that or if you want to help out on that, he's got a website and the website's called recallpat.com. You can check that out.
And if he wants to stop by and pick up some signatures here at the station, I'm sure
he'll get a few.
Certain of us here would be happy to sign. The other half of this story is also very interesting, which is as soon as the Supreme Court announced this, Davis announced that she would not be running for re-election next year. Her actual term expires at the end of 2009.
She's been port commissioner for over 20 years.
Yeah, she's been port commissioner basically since pterodactyls roamed the earth, but and has been lining the pockets of the various corporate patrons at the Port of Seattle with taxpayer money since about that time. Davis, among other things, was the brain trust who brought you WTO. There's been any number of dubious back scratching kind of deals over the years that Davis has had her hands in, and she announced that she wouldn't be running for re-election essentially as a form of damage control, figuring, well, if I'm out anyway, then people won't sign the petition, because the issue is this isn't just about Davis. The issue is also about precedent, because it's not just Pat Davis that is the problem at the Port to Seattle, even though Davis herself has had a reprehensible record, and even though the other port commissioners are such that they'll probably name something nice and fancy on the waterfront after her, the way they did with Pat Paige Miller when she retired. The issue is really whether this kind of behavior, whether the back scratching and cronyism and corruption is going to continue at the port or not. And all indications are now, certainly from the response to last year's performance audit by Brian Sontag's state office, and the very defensive reaction to it and the very slow response by the port in enacting some of the recommended reforms that we learned this week, Pat Davis has been instrumental in helping to craft, which is a little frightening in itself. The culture of corruption at the port continues, and that corruption is what needs to be challenged even more than Davis's tenure itself needs to be challenged. So the recall really needs support, not just to get Pat out of office, but so this whole thing doesn't get swept under the rug and business as usual doesn't continue long after Pat Davis is retired.
All right.
Or been retired.
Right.
Another signature gathering.
Yeah,
effort?
there is another signature gathering drive going on even as we speak. It turns out some folks want the residents of the city of Seattle to reject the plastic grocery bag fee. Signature gatherers are at supermarkets and other public places are trying to get some 14,000 signatures by August 28th to get this on the ballot for next year. Well, you can take a quick guess on who's financing the signature drive for this initiative.
And why it is that grocery stores would allow private signature gatherers on their property.
Yeah, the Washington food industry, which represents a lot of the grocery industry, 7-Eleven Inc. is a major supporter of the initiative drive, and you can see why, since they rely on the quick stop, in and out, spur of the moment purchase. They're assuming people are not going to carry a reusable bag around with them everywhere, and they think that this bag fee will impact their business. And also a national group called the American Chemistry Council. As it turns out, they represent, well, plastic bag manufacturers have been pouring a lot of money into trying to defeat initiatives all over the country that have been trying to limit the use of plastic bags in places like California as well as here in Washington State. And then also a Democratic legislator, Representative Dean Tacko, I think, T-A-K-K-O, from Longview. He's taken quite a bit of money from the timber industry and from Weyerhaeuser. He's trying to craft legislation for the legislature in the upcoming session to ban any kind of restrictions on the use of paper bags in the state of Washington.
Saw that one coming.
Yeah, really. So these things are getting up steam. If you encounter any of the signature gatherers on the street, feel free to tell them what you think. A lot of the initiative gatherers are using a statistic. They say that they're calling this the plastic bag fee, quote, a $300 a year tax on Seattle residents. But if you actually do the numbers, you see that $300 a year assumes that you would have to use 1,500 bags in a year, or approximately 4 bags every single day of the year, in order to end up paying $300 a year.
And that would be a voluntary tax, since you can get around it very easily by not using plastic bags.
Yeah, by using the free bags that the city are going to provide to Seattle residents.
All right. Moving on to National and Monsanto in the news.
Speaking of plastics.
Or maybe not in the news.
Monsanto, which is well known for its moves in the genetically engineered department to get genetically engineered seeds on the market. Their first genetically engineered product was bovine growth hormone, though. And it turns out that they announced plans this week to sell off the only plant that they have operating these days that manufactures bovine growth hormone. If we look at the recent history, major retailers in the U.S., a lot of major retailers in the U.S. have banned bovine growth hormone milk from their store brands. Safeway, Publix, Kroger, which owns QFC and Fred Meyer, have banned it. And Starbucks announced that they won't buy milk with bovine growth hormone in it. And then in January, Kraft Foods announced that they would offer a line of cheese products that don't contain BGH. So the movement clearly in the United States is against it. We're lagging behind the European Union, which banned it long ago, and Australia, Japan, and other industrialized nations that don't allow BGH in their food supply. And we just want to point out that bovine growth hormone treated cows have an increased amount of IGF-1, which is a growth hormone. So if you're drinking milk from cows treated with bovine growth hormone, you might want to consider switching, because IGF-1 can cause cells to proliferate in your body, including cancer cells. So it's definitely a health risk. And not just to humans, but also to the cows themselves, because cows treated with BGH often need higher levels of antibiotics than other cows on a dairy farm.
And, of course, it's the marketplace that's had to decide this, because the FDA has been completely missing in action.
Yeah, the FDA and the USDA.
In fact, there was even a major effort to stop companies that wanted to print, you know,
yes.
BGH
that
free.
That became illegal in order to do that.
Yeah. Imagine that. All right, moving on to international and the current conflict in Georgia and Russia.
Oh, goody. Yeah, believe it or not, this did not start with Russia's invasion of Georgia. Now, you may not be aware of that, because U.S. media has not paid the least bit of attention to what actually started this crisis, which was in when Georgia sent troops into and bombed the province of South Ossetia, which has a large which has a large Russian minority population in it, and which has tried, at the time of the breakup of the Soviet Union, to not be part of Georgia. So this has been a long simmering conflict, and Georgia did this knowing that they would provoke a reaction from Russia, and yet in U.S. media coverage and coverage by U.S. politicians, and particularly the White House and the McCain campaign, it has been all the poor, struggling democratic country of Georgia all the time. It's not quite that simple.
Yeah, nor is it simply because of the oil pipelines that run through Georgia either. I've seen a lot of people say, well, it's because Russia wants that oil. Well, not necessarily. There were a lot of things going on in Georgia right up to the time the bombing was ordered. It would be a reasonable as well as an intelligent thing to ask, well, why did Georgia invade South Ossetia? Well, Saakashvili, the Georgian president, had been under fire from the Georgian opposition for many, many months now. And in the weeks leading up to the attempted invasion of South Ossetia, Georgia had been experiencing massive demonstrations in the capital to try to unseat Saakashvili.
In other words, he tried to start a war to get domestic political pressure off of him.
Yes.
Where have we heard this before?
Yeah, that's a typical U.S. tactic. Well, in addition, Russia responded immediately. Russia's not blameless in this. In addition to bombing and going after Georgian troops, they went well into Georgian territory, bombed the city of Gori and several villages around it, which was not entirely called for. But you have to put this into the perspective of U.S.-Russian relations. The U.S. is a very strong supporter of Georgia when other nations in the international community have not been. And the U.S. has been putting a lot of pressure on Russia through our foreign policy, which relies on this Cold War mentality of we must contain the Soviet threat, even though the Soviet threat is long gone. The U.S. has been putting what they call a missile shield program into nations like Poland and Czechoslovakia. Well, that's highly provocative to Russia.
Yeah. And saying that it's there to guard against threat from Iranian missiles when, you know, everybody knows that it's aimed at Russia. It's not aimed at Iran.
It's not aimed at Iran, no.
Yeah. The other interesting connection about this is that the very typical idea of, well, let's start a war in order to get domestic political pressure. The president of Georgia has a very close advisor in the United States. He is the same man and the same lobbyist for the Georgian government who heads John McCain's foreign policy team. And so when you see McCain out in front on this issue and advocating for the poor, beleaguered democracy of Georgia, bear in mind that he's getting his information from a very close advisor, and he himself, as he is pointing out repeatedly in the past week, has been to Georgia a number of times. He's very close to the Georgian regime and is not at all a neutral player in this, and in fact it's not at all inconceivable that each is scratching the other's back for domestic political purposes here, that the Americans told the Georgian leader that, yeah, go ahead and start your little flare-up and we'll back you up on this and we'll help you with your domestic politics, and then what McCain gets out of it is the ability to look presidential and to trump up his relative supposed depth of foreign policy experience compared to Barack Obama. And of course the problem with this is that both in South Ossetia and in Georgian cities like Gori, people are dying in large numbers, and these sorts of geopolitical games tend to mask the fact that ordinary people have their lives destroyed as a result.
Maria, did you want to continue on the subject of the missile shield?
No, we talked about it already.
All right. Well, with that, got about 5 minutes left, and that leaves time for Jav and you guys have an event coming up today.
Well, there's several events this week. Of course, HempFest is going on all this weekend, starting at 10 o'clock today and tomorrow at Merle Edwards Park, and picking up over the course of the over the course of both days. And by all means, bring plenty of sunscreen, because there's not a whole lot of shade in Merle Edwards Park, although hopefully there will be a breeze in the water.
There might be a haze covering over the area.
Yeah, that's true.
A little smoky haze.
just don't inhale. Anyway.
No, do inhale. It'll make it a lot more enjoyable.
I was thinking of the ozone myself, but I don't know what you're thinking of. In any event, also on Monday night, the 19th, Jim Hightower will be in town. He'll be at Elliott Bay Books at 7:30 talking about his latest amusingly titled book. And Eat the State is having an event today also, our annual summer picnic slash barbecue. This year it's going to be in Woodland Park from 1 to 4 o'clock this afternoon in a nice, cool, shady part of Woodland Park. It's very pleasant, and we would love to see people come out there. But the directions are a little bit complicated. It's picnic tables 17 and 18 in Woodland Park, and to get there, there's an entrance at 50th and Woodland Park Avenue North. That's just east of Aurora on the Stone Way side of Woodland Park. There's a little loop that enters off of there. It's at the north end of the park, just about at the crest of the loop, but it's not right actually by the roadside. It's in the middle, and you'll see us in there. Tables 17 and 18 will be there from 1 until 4 o'clock this afternoon. Stop by. We'd love to meet you, hang out, have some food, enjoy the sunshine and the shade, and
if you missed our recent fund drive, you could also donate to us.
Drive's still going.
Is it still going?
we've been struggling in our fund drive, quite frankly, because it's hard to raise money in the summer, and we owe a lot of money to the printer. So if you could help us out with that, either by stopping by this afternoon or by donating through the PayPal button at eatthestate.org, where all the election endorsements are also. That's www.eatthestate.org. Or send donations to P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington 98145. That information is on the website too. Or just doesn't have to be money. It can also be time. Help out, volunteer, distribute. We always need distributors. We always need writers and proofreaders and all that kind of good stuff. So that's how a volunteer publication like this works. It's a labor of love, and we do the radio show and do the website and do the newspaper just because we want to try and get the information and the analysis out. So help us out if you're so inclined.
Yeah, and even if you're not interested in donating or volunteering, it's great to see people at the picnic who are just readers and just want to give us a little feedback, or just want to hang out for a little bit, see who it is that who those voices are on the radio, and who it is who writes those articles and wants to just kind of rub elbows, talk about things that they haven't heard us talk about, or whatever. It's always fun to get feedback from readers.
Yeah, and you'll both
and listeners.
And listeners.
You'll both be there?
Yes.
Yes.
All right. Still another minute left for we wouldn't be correct if we didn't do some Olympic coverage like every other station in town.
Three letters, CBC.
Yeah. Job is lucky. He's got cable, so he gets to watch it on the Canadian stations. I'm stuck with the NBC, which has had atrocious coverage. Not only is it not live, it's heavily biased towards Americans, which are not always the most interesting athletes in any event, and not always the most interesting events in the Olympics going on at that time.
And not the only athletes.
Let alone the best.
Yes, and cuts away for commercials frequently in the middle of an event that it's critical to see from start to finish. And I kind of wonder myself, having been a little girl who got the bug to do exercise by watching the Olympics when I was very young, and able to watch events from start to finish then and see how the athletes performed and how they did their techniques, and then be able to use that myself. I wonder how many kids nowadays get that opportunity, especially in a country where we have ever-increasing rates of obesity in young people.
So, I don't know if it's tied to the official...
That's my Olympic rant.
...official restaurant of the Olympics is McDonald's.
McDonald's, so. Yeah.
There you have it. All right, talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. And one more time, where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org, or email us for information or feedback or tips at info@eatthestate.org.